Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we all grapple with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Happy Healthy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Healthy Tuesday, Rachel.
What's on your mind today?
Oh, there's always so much on my mind, as you know. The hard part is always kind of encapsulating what's on my mind in the moment to make sense of our conversation on Tuesdays. But I will start here. I want to recognize that there is a lot going on in the world right now. And part of me grappled with whether or not we should be diving into conversations about the deep adolescent rebellion that is happening in many portions of this country. And we should talk about how we discipline adolescents who have gone astray. But we have time to have those conversations, I think, because I don't believe that the adolescent uprising is over yet. And with all of the news that consistently overwhelms us, I love today's topic because it's a respite from the things that stress us. And we're a show about mental health, if we're about anything. And we're going to talk about the spirit of winemakers. And it's kind of a continuing conversation that we had earlier last year about the spirit of wine. And my guest today is Dr. Stephen Lloyd Moffitt. He is a professor at Cal Poly. And I would say, I hope that we've become friends over the last couple of years, because I think he's one of my most visited guests on the show. If I were to count up over the last 10 years, I think we've had 4 or 5 conversations. So I clearly completely enjoy his company, and I love to listen to him tell stories. And so I thought, one, I've been working my way through his new book, The Spirit of Winemakers, and I have so many dog-eared pages and so many things I want to talk to him about that I wanted to get him on the air to talk about it and maybe encourage you to grab his book and enjoy some of the stories. And also to take a moment to step into how we find our spiritual selves, how we find our calm, how we find our breath. Because I've noticed in the last couple of weeks, more than usual, I'm doing a lot of upper chest breathing, kind of that panting, hyperventilating breathing. I'm moving a little too quickly. When I'm lecturing with my students, I find myself having to stop and catch my breath. Everything feels to be moving more rapidly than it should. And so I remind myself that I need to kind of take a break and calm my central nervous system and focus on what is happening now and try to tap into those things that make me feel grounded. And for many people, that grounding comes in the form of some sort of religious practice, whatever that is. And I'm not even going to tap into all the different forms of potential religious practices, because that would insult my guest, Dr. Stephen Lloyd Moffitt, who is waiting patiently for me to get through this, because that is his area of expertise. But I just feel more than ever that I need to remind us all to take a breath. So we're going to do that now. Not the kind of breath that is panty in our chest, but that kind of breath that happens when you sit and you let your belly relax, you kind of unzip your pants after a big meal and just let it all hang. And then you take that breath of satisfaction that allows you to slow down your heart rate and look around and notice the things that are beautiful in your life just for a moment. And then you'll sense this well-being kind of comes over you. And then you're able to take in new information. Because when we're in that fight or flight mode of moving quickly and feeling like we're under attack and feeling as if we should flee, we can't take in new information. We're just surviving. We're just trying to fend off attacks. So in order to really be able to take in anything new, we have to calm the fight or flight. We have to get back into our sense of groundedness. And then food starts to taste better again. And our conversations with our family tend to make more sense. And our ability to listen to news or listen to conversations gets in a little deeper. And we can actually read a magazine article and remember what we read. You know, those things only happen when we've calmed our central nervous system down a bit to take in new information. And for many people, that also includes a glass of wine at some point during the day that helps to calm the central nervous system and focus our mind and open us to new ideas. So take your breath. And today we're going to talk about the stories of different winemakers from around the world and how they connect their spiritual lives to the art of making wine. and we'll probably go in 50 different directions if I know my guest at all along the lines of these stories. And although we don't have the phone lines open, you can always call to share a comment or question for my guest, 805-549-8853. Rachel is happy to read your comment or questions over the air, and we'll be happy to answer them. You can be a part of the show by sending me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. Follow us on Instagram, elizabeth_TRT, or Facebook, Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I encourage you to podcast our show. You can subscribe by visiting Apple Podcasts, A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Hit subscribe and the show will be available to listen to at your convenience. And you can also visit kcbx.org under A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And all my shows for the last 10 years, including my four with Dr. Stephen Lloyd Moffitt, which you'll probably want to visit after hearing him speak today. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And you're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. We're going to listen to a little Pinot Noir music to get in the mood for today. And we'll be back to talk with my guest.
A tear of joy my eye lets loose is reflected in the glass, which holds the holy garnet juice that embodies a season past. Better than that Irish whiskey resting in a jar, my beloved Pinot Noir. Dark cherry, bright acidity, a hint of forest floor. Thin-skinned in its humility, who could ask for anything more? Better than an expensive Cuban cigar, my beloved Pinot Noir.
Delicate fruit. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, and I welcome my guest, Dr. Stephen Lloyd Moffitt, to the show. How are you, Stephen?
Great, Elizabeth. Thanks for having me on again. I always enjoy our conversations. I wish it was in person, but we look forward to that sometime soon.
I look forward to it. I might just show up at your office socially distanced so we can carry on the conversations. But before we jump in, you sent me this song, My Beloved Pinot Noir. We heard just a snippet of. Where did you get this song?
Well, it's by a couple of good friends of ours, Jason and Debbie Manville. And she has a beautiful voice. And Jason is a very talented songwriter. But I sent it to you because it really shows the ability of wine to inspire people. And I think right now we're all looking for some sort of inspiration. And so Jason and Debbie are very spiritual people and they're involved in their church, but they also find in wine that mystery, that depth, that meaning, the friendships that come with it. And like many people in the COVID period, Jason has channeled a lot of his thoughts into music, and this is what came out, a ode to Pinot Noir. And unfortunately, Amy and I share that love of Pinot Noir with them and with so many around the world, and so I wanted to sort of give that as a gift to you and to everyone listening, because it's just a beautiful song that captures the spirit of Pinot Noir and the spirit of wine and everything that comes with it.
Well, and I was looking at your bio in the book, so I'm going to steal a little bit from it because it tells probably a little bit about how you got to writing about Pinot Noir or just writing about wine in general. Dr. Stephen Lloyd Moffitt is a professor of religious studies at Cal Poly, amateur winemaker, and caretaker of a backyard vineyard. It does go on with your other credentials along with your PhD and in theological studies from UCSB. And you're also the chair of the Religious Studies Department at Cal Poly. You have spent a lifetime studying and traveling and being a part of the religious world. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah. And I think what's fascinating about this project is I think at the beginning of my PhD studies, if I considered if I would ever write a book on wine, it just seemed the farthest thing from my mind. But as I began to meet people in the wine industry and the people with whom we share a love of wine, I saw in them so many of the characteristics that I find in spiritual people around the world. And they may not call themselves devotees of wine. Very few would identify being in the first church of wine or you know, imagine Dionysius behind it all anymore. But, you know, there's so many similarities. And so this project really just started to try to make sense of the people that I came to know and love through wine.
So what came first, your position as an amateur winemaker and caretaker of backyard vineyard, or your appreciation of wine?
Well, first we got into wine, and, you know, partially being part of the Central Coast, right now I'm speaking to you from the philosophy hallway, and a bunch of us in philosophy would meet together monthly to taste wine, to share the experience of new wines, and that naturally led to a desire to make wine. And for many of us, that experience was really transformational. And it brought not just a new level to our understanding of wine, but mostly a new level of friendship with each other. And that's what wine does so often, that it becomes the glue that brings people together. And that's true of the industry of wine. That's true for those of us who are close with different wine tasting communities.
And so I'm not really sure where to start, but let's jump into the book. So this is the second, I don't know if you considered it was going to be a series, but the second book, The Spirit of Winemakers. So the first book talked about wine itself as a spiritual practice in some ways. That's a very general overview. But for those who haven't read it, it's called The Spirit of Wine, Finding Religion in the Fruit of the Vine. And now this follow-up, The Spirit of Winemakers, Finding Religion from the Vineyard to the Bottle, you go through five different, what seems like spiritual paths or perspectives, and then you have interviews with different winemakers who kind of fall under those different, what I think are spiritual perspectives. You can correct me.
I think what the first book was really, if you want to make wine part of your spiritual life, how do you do that? And being an academic, I studied that the same way that we study everything else. You go and talk to people, you read, you explore. And I went to wineries on three different continents, had over 100 interviews, and people were just so generous with their time with me. I think in part because, unlike the wine press, who, you know, is always about marketing or technical stuff, I just asked them how they feel. And Elizabeth, you do this every week. You know, how do you feel? What is it, you know, what's important to you? And so some of the most famous winemakers in the world opened their doors to me. And, you know, initially it was really about what is this thing wine? And I went to the people who are most enmeshed in that life. But then as I came to talk to them, I came to realize there's a second story to tell. And that is how these winemakers imagine their business, because for them, it's not just about making wine and making money. Or at least if you started off that way, you realize there isn't a lot of money to be made in wine. But instead, they felt that they were called to make wine. And every one of them would volunteer some sort of conversion story. And as someone trained to look at the religious lives of people, you know, I could easily put them in conversion stories. Why, for them, it was just, you know, a moment in their life. And maybe there's one example of that I think was meaningful to me was Jeff Morgan, who is the founder of Covenant Wines, which is one of the great kosher wines in the world. And he was in music in New York. He was a band leader. And sometime in his 30s, he was feeling very empty in the life of music, and just thought there had to be something else. And he went up upstate New York and was just going through a personal crisis. And he got to the point where he just found this river and sat on a rock and said, I'm not leaving this rock until I have a sign something about, you know, to turn my life around. And he claims he heard the river tell him why. Why? And so from that moment on, he reoriented his life. He eventually volunteered at a winery in Long Island, eventually started writing about wine, eventually started a wine label. And as he retells his story, he looks back on it and sees that this whole adventure in wine was guided by something bigger. And he actually discovered his Judaism through his adventure in wine. He had never been bar mitzvahed in his life because he grew up a rather secular Jew. And it was at a winery one time during harvest in the midst of a vat that the rabbi blessing the wine gave him his bar mitzvah. And so his story of wine is intertwined with his spiritual life. And what the second volume tries to do is to tell those stories, to allow their experience in wine, their experience in their career come to light and allow them to understand how the things we do and the things we spend our energy on can also be driven by our spiritual vocations as well.
If you're just tuning in, my guest is Dr. Stephen Lloyd Moffat. He is a professor of religious studies at Cal Poly, amateur winemaker, which I'll keep referring back to because of our topic today, and caretaker of a backyard vineyard. And what inspired our conversation today is his new book, The Spirit of Winemakers. And we're talking about the religious or spiritual stories underneath winemakers around the world. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And I have two questions. One's going to veer us away and one will bring us back. But I wonder, Stephen, there must be, for many people who are on a path, whatever, whether they become winemakers or they hear God tell them to follow wine, how often do you think in people's lives they get a conversion or a message that they tap into? Just in your experience, how many people that you've met in your lifetime can say to you, I found my path because I had this moment?
Yeah, I mean, I think the answer to that is really few. But if I were to go with the people who I've come to admire and appreciate and who are happiest in their life, that answer is many. Because I think, you know, when people find something that is both personally fulfilling, meaningful, in a bigger picture, their whole life becomes more cohesive. There's more integrity in different elements. And so, you know, one of the joys of getting to talk to so many winemakers who are spiritually fulfilled is, you know, they are passionate about their wine, and their enthusiasm just spills over into our discussion. So there's no way that you can't share in their lung, because, you know, yes, they're making an agricultural product, right? They're taking grapes, squeezing them, and putting them in a bottle, but they all frame that endeavor in terms of something that's so much bigger and so much more meaningful that it's hard just to sort of pound a glass of their wine afterwards. You know, it's like they are putting themselves in it. They're putting their families, their workers in it. And they really feel like they are vehicles of, at a very minimum, the earth and the love that came into that relationship between the winemaker and the earth and this agricultural product. So when they share their stories, you come to feel that I'm not just drinking a wine or buying a product, but I am part of something bigger. And the more humans can construct themselves into such narratives, I think the more meaning people have in their lives.
So maybe people have had these messages of where they should go. They just didn't recognize it, but they found their way in spite or despite, right? In spite of having that message come to them.
Yeah. I mean, I think some are very over the top, like, you know, Jeff Morgan's or John Alden. We talk about his conversion experience in the book. Others are more subtle. But I think there's something unique about wine, not totally unique, but hardly anyone feels called to grow cucumbers. You know, very few would sit there and say, you know, I think God wants me to be an investment banker. But there is something about wine that you connect with this ancient trajectory. You connect with the soil. You connect with people looking for solace in the wines they drink. And that allows you to jump into this stream full on and find something meaningful. And the, you know, it's a joy for me to be able to share those stories, because these are all people whose lives have been transformed by wine in positive ways.
So can we talk a bit about kind of the religious traditions of wine, you know, that some of the vineyards, some of the vines have been in production since Jesus walked the earth. Can we talk about the religious history as it connects to wine?
Yeah, so I mean, wine has been a sign of blessing in many different religious traditions, but particularly Judaism and Christianity. You know, wine has always been a part. Of course, the most famous winemaker in the world is Jesus. You know, he begins his ministry by turning water into wine, a slightly unorthodox method. But what's fascinating about that story, just on the side, is it's at the end of the evening, so people have already been drinking, and he decides that despite everybody already been drinking, we don't give them the you know, equivalent of the $5 plunk. We give them the best wine. And that's a story about hospitality. Even at the end of the evening, your guests deserve your finest wine. Keep opening, says Jesus. But it certainly has this history through the monastic traditions that we see in Christianity. Wine was a central part of that vocation. You see it to a lesser extent, but somewhat in Buddhist traditions as well, a history of winemaking. But really, it was integrated into their spiritual lives. Every, you know, one of my favorite stories about monastic drinking wine is a rule among the Dominicans that you must have wine at every meal, but you're never allowed to pour your own glass. That is, you must always be oriented outward. Find the empty glass at your table and share God's love through a pour. And I think that sort of attitude is something that we can share with that long trajectory of wine and religion.
So in the monastic traditions that you talked about, I think if I remember correctly, that wine was drunk at high volumes because the water was not potable, right? So that kind of was the
start. Yeah, well, that's true all over the ancient world. Yeah, when you couldn't drink water because of parasites and other things, yeah, you drank wine. And so wine was a part of life. It was a part of daily life. The St. Benedict in Benedict's Rule says every monk should drink the equivalent of a bottle and a third a day. So if you're feeling, you know, worried about your alcohol consumption or your partner is, always remind themselves that the people of God drink probably more.
And how do you think the wine consumption of the monastic traditions influenced the religious writings and practices that we see today?
Yeah, well, I think one of the fascinating aspects about this, and Elizabeth and I were talking right before the show, is John Alban in our backyard, one of the most famous winemakers in the world, and a deeply spiritual guy, even if he's not the most outgoing on that aspect of his life. But he told me that, you know, one of the things that he models his vineyard care over is Lectio Divino, the close divine reading of scripture. Because God writes in the Bible and in nature. And the same care that those monks showed towards a careful reading of scripture, John says that's what a good vineyard manager does to his or her vines. That is, you see God's imprint there and you look for those messages. And for those who are attuned, when they walk through their vineyards, they see so much more than merely a scientific process going on. There is photosynthesis, there is, you know, missing ingredients and soil structures or whatever, but there's also some sort of spirit that's present there. And if you're willing to be open to that, you feel something deep there. I actually start off the Spirit of Winemakers with the story of a woman in Australia who was a vineyard manager and then went off to India and came back. And she, after her experience in India and in the Himalayas, she came back and each week she made a vow to touch each vine and just say, I love you. I love you. And she was convinced that that energy transfer, just through her intention on the vine, made the vines happier, and the happier vines created better wine. And so that sort of attitude, really, you can see play again and again. And this can be Jeff Pipes of Pipestone in Paso Robles. He uses feng shui to organize his vineyards. I know other vineyard managers have put crystals at the end of different rows. There's a famous story, Dominique Lafon, a very famous Burgundian winemaker. He was absolutely convinced with a new vineyard that he bought that the orientation was wrong. So he just flipped it and is convinced that that channeled the energy in a different way. And so all over the world, there are winemakers who are attuned to the material and the immaterial parts of wineries, of vineyards, and that they think elevates the wine.
My guest is Dr. Stephen Lloyd Moffitt, and we're talking about the spirit of winemakers and how, I don't know how to step into it, but how the spiritual connection to their vineyards had ignited the spiritual journeys of many winemakers. Conversely, how the spiritual grounding of winemakers was infused into their vineyards. And we're kind of going through some of the stories in Stephen's new book that is filled with fascinating stories. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And if you have a question or comment, you can give us a call at 805-549-8853, and Rachel will be happy to read your question on the air. We're going to take a quick break, listen to a version of Lilac Wine from Jeff Buckley in 1994, absolutely stunning, and we'll be back to continue our conversation with Dr. Stephen Lloyd Moffitt. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
I lost myself on a cool, damp night. I lost myself on a cool, damp night. I gave myself in that misty light. I was hypnotized by a strange delight under a lilac tree. Made wine from the lilac tree. I put my heart in its recipe, 'cause it makes me see what I want to see. Be with whom I want to be. But I think more than I want to think. Do things I never should do. I drink much more than I ought to drink, because it brings me back you. You, you, you.
This is A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. If you have questions you want to have answered, our phone number is 805-549-8855. Elizabeth, back to you.
Thank you. And my guest, Dr. Stephen Lloyd Moffitt. Okay, Stephen, I want to jump into some of the nitty-gritty of the book. And the chapter that I could not stop reading was the one on biodynamics and the cosmic forces and energy infused practices that were influenced by Rudolf Steiner. The history was fascinating. So can you kind of give an overview and then talk about how it's in practice?
Yeah, so Rudolf Steiner was one of those sort of uniquely end of the 19th century, early 20th century thinkers that wanted to really understand every part of life. And so he wrote volumes and was responsible for some amazing things. The Camp Hill movement, which is a school for the developmentally disabled, Eurythmia, which is a dance model, Anthroposophy, which is kind of a spiritual system, and biodynamics, which is an agriculture system. And so this is part of a wider worldview. And it was really shaped in many deep ways by the experience of World War I, which was seen as a big shock to the system. How could humans be so barbaric with each other? How could it be that just there was war and hatred all around? And part of Steiner's analysis is that we have come to ignore the spirit in what we eat, that for time millennia, people who were attuned to not just the nutritional value of food, but the spiritual value of food. And with modern farming, we have come to ignore the ways in which things like planetary movements, like subtle energy force, like connecting different sort of tides and spiritual energy with our food. And so Steiner proposed that we reconnect spirituality and agriculture so that our foods become filled with the spiritual energy as well. And in the big picture, once humans start consuming these spirit-filled foods, we will tend to reorient our life, our relationship to the earth and to each other. And so for Steiner, biodynamics was bringing the venami, the spirit, back into the bios, to the earth, to biology, and then allowing that to be transferred into humans. And so biodynamics was a farming method that consciously made farmers aware of not just the material parts of the soil and the foods we grow, but also the spiritual parts of it. It has a smaller following in agricultural world, so it's there. But where it's taken off over the last 40 years is in wine. And it is a fascinating sign, because I don't think Steiner imagined wine as a primary vehicle for spirituality. But if you look at the, say, top 200 wineries in the world by most critic standards, probably 60 to 70% of them are now following Steiner's model for how to farm. And so even if you're just sort of a crass materialist, you've got to wonder, why is it that so much great wine has been influenced by this guy who really didn't know anything about wine, or really didn't even know that much about agriculture, but had a basic idea to reinvigorate vines and our food and drink with the foundational spiritual elements of the universe, to reconnect what we eat with the spiritual foundation. And so biodynamic winemakers, there's a whole system developed by Steiner, which includes, you know, adding things like you bury a cow's horn with manure in it at the fall equinox, you exhume it in the spring equinox, you take out that that evolved manure, you pour it in water, you stir with intention for an hour, and then you spray it with intention on it. And what's fascinating for those of us who are in the academic world is they've tried to do studies to say, oh, does it make a difference? And that misses the point. We don't have a tool to study spiritual depth. We don't have a measurement to, you know, to tackle the Holy Spirit in a cucumber or a grape. And so there won't be any science to be able to prove it. But there's even a lot of sort of really skeptical people in the world of wine who look at a biodynamic vineyard and find in it just a sense of richness and depth and spirit that's not found in non-biodynamic vineyards.
And you bring up in some ways almost a bigger part of the topic is where we are as a society. You know, Steiner would say part of the reason that we're in such disarray and chaos is that we've had three generations of In-N-Out and McDonald's, and no one has the nutrition to, you know, create this spiritual being. So we just have angry, disconnected people. But then the other part is the part of that science plays in it. You know, since the 1950s, the mantra was that science would cure all ills, social and environmental. And in some ways, if things cannot be measured empirically, they do not count. And so there's this, to me, this, you did a great job of talking about how some science is not measurable in our traditional forms, and that should not negate when you can observe actual changes in the vines and the grapes. Something has changed, whether or not we can measure it scientifically. That might be too many comments.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and I interviewed a lot of winemakers who are kind of very much at the science side of life, and they're atheists, and they are very into the chemical compound, this and that. But they're also practice biodynamics, and I would ask them, how do you reconcile those two? And for many of them, they would simply say there's some things that science can't measure. And I can tell you that something has changed in our vineyard. And I won't be able to chemically break down what that difference is, but something has changed. And so I'm willing to allow a something immaterial, even if I can't completely sort of explain it yet. Though something, there will be a time when you can explain it scientifically. But it really, and people are different levels of adherence to biodynamics. One of our great vineyards of the Central Coast, Bassey Vineyard, which is farmed by Mike Steiner over in Avila. You know, they are biodynamic. Mike is a wonderful proponent of it. And Mike, you know, Mike is a down to earth guy. He loves to tell the story of how his house growing up bordered a junkyard, you know, and you know, real solid business and farmer. But when he starts talking about his vineyard, and when he starts talking about the wine that comes up, when he starts talking about Sangiovese Valley, which is his label, which he literally has the thumbprint of he and his wife on it. It is not just a agricultural product. It is a part of him, and his ability to channel the spiritual energy of that vineyard through his frame and into that bottle is the story of Sangiovese Valley. That wine, I think, tastes different because he's at least cognizant of the spiritual values that can be found in soils and place and in people. And putting that into a bottle becomes part of the magic of making a great, great wine.
I keep going back to this story I read long ago about the unintended consequence of the microwave oven. And although microwave ovens made things convenient and we could cook, you know, foods very quickly, it prevented people from sitting, you know, making a meal, putting together all of the components and creating a meal with love. And as they put together all the ingredients, they're thinking about the people that will eat their food, and they're kind of in, you know, putting their heart and their love into the food they're creating. And then in some ways that food is more nutritious than food that you pop out of a microwave or made from a soulless kitchen. So is that kind of what you're talking about, is that there is more, And I'm trying to avoid using the word with intention, because you kind of mock intention in the book. So I'm worried to say it, but I have to say that when we do things, when we cook with intention and say, I make this because I love my family, somehow it's more nutritious.
Yeah, I mean, intention is just the secular word for prayer. You know, I'm fine with it. But, you know, it's interesting. Probably the most renowned wine in the world is Domaine Romani Conti. It's a little 5-acre parcel of Burgundy. Each bottle goes for around $2,000 a bottle. I mean, it's impossible to get. And it's just hallowed ground. I mean, literally, there have been heists of people trying to steal vines from it. I mean, it's an amazing place. The owner and winemaker there is this guy, Aubert de Verlaine. And if there is a pope in wine or a holy figure, it's him. I mean, everybody venerates him. He is an older French man that has oozes gravitas and wisdom. And he was very kind to spend a few hours with me to talk about, you know, what makes this wine worth $2,000? Like, how is it? And at the end of the interview, we're kind of going back and forth on stuff and their biodynamic and some other things. And I said, well, you know, why don't I just ask, what's the difference, Aubert, in this than the wine I make? And he looks at me just very straightly and says, love. What we bottle is love. And everybody tries to do all these different things. And yes, we do them too. You know, we are very meticulous in our farming. We're very clean as a winery. We do all this stuff. But without love, what is there? And you know, for someone in religious studies, that's the end of almost every conversation that I have with religious figures. You know, is that, as Paul says, you know, without love is a clanging cymbal or an empty gong, right? That it's just, what can make a great wine is this mind frame that I'm not just creating a product to sell at a store, but I'm bottling a love that's bigger than me. And the winemakers who can pull that off, who really put themselves into it, are the ones that make the wines we remember. They make the wines that we can't forget. Maybe it's a better way.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to my guest, Dr. Stephen Lloyd Moffatt, author of The Spirit of Winemakers, Finding Religion from the Vineyard to the Bottle. So how do people, I just went online and Googled the book and found it. Is that the quickest, easiest way to get this?
Yeah, Amazon is always the easiest. It comes in a couple of days. Or we have a website, spiritofwinebook.com, and there's lots more information. And if you want a signed copy, you can always contact me through that.
Yes, I want my copy signed. I would like a letter written inside my book at some point. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And we're talking about some of the stories in this book about winemakers and their own spiritual journeys, from Jewish mysticism and Taoist philosophy to Zen meditation and Hindu-inspired crystals. All of these things have gone into different wines. And when we're not talking about regular wines, as Stephen was just saying, we're talking about winemakers who sell their wine for $2,000 a bottle, or some don't market their wines at all because it sells out before it's even brought to market. So Stephen, we talked a little bit about biodynamics. Let's talk about the Wu Wei winemakers and what that means and how they implement that.
Yeah, well, you know, I get very hesitant about talking about universals in religion, right? It's almost always you can find some exception somewhere. But if I sort of, you know, gently go down towards things that are extremely, extremely common, let's say, I would think, you know, two elements of most religious worldviews are faith and humility. You know, you might have faith in different things, but there's a profound faith and humility. And what I started to see in a lot of the winemakers, the ones that I really came to admire and respect, were those two elements. They have faith in the land, in their grapes. And so they don't feel called to have to manipulate it that much. They, because, you know, the secret of a lot of cheap wine is that a lot of what's in the bottle is actually chemicals and manipulated. Because wine is one of those rare products that they don't have to say what's inside it. You know, most things we eat or drink have to give an ingredient list. Wine doesn't have to do that. And the way you make a decent $5 bottle of wine is you manipulate the heck out of it. And the reason why a lot of those $5 bottles of wine create headaches is because not of the grapes, but because of the chemicals that are put in it. And especially today with the industry of wine, we have figured out technology to make wine mimic the kinds of things that consumer wants, that consumers want, so that we can charge a high price for it. And so a lot of wines are quite manipulated. But the winemakers I really came to admire were ones that had trust in their system. That is, they believed that if they left their grapes under the right conditions, it would make a great wine. And what's fascinating about that is a phrase that you see in Burgundy a lot, which is you have to have the courage to do nothing. The courage to do nothing. That is to trust in it. Now, when I would share that with people, you know, some winemakers would say, yes, but that doesn't mean I sort of throw grapes in a vat and then go play golf for 4 months. I'm constantly trying to create the conditions so that the wines can be what they want to be. That is not to impose myself on it. That is not to put them in too hot a place or too cold a place, not to sort of, you know, manipulate them. And in searching for some terminology to understand this process, I turned to Taoism, because in Taoism, there's this notion called Wu Wei, which is sort of to actively remain passive. That is a trust in the Tao. The Tao is the harmonizing force in the universe and will bring things to goodness and unity. But humans get in the way. And so when things go wrong in life, it's because humans have imposed their will on the natural harmonizing force of the Tao. And so if there is division in our world, if there is fights between people, it's because of the human imposition that blocks the Tao's natural tendency to bring people together. And this Wu Wei is exactly what the great winemakers are trying to do. They're trying to actively get out of the way, to actively be passive and allow the grapes to express themselves in whatever way they have. And that is the faith in the vines, the faith in the land, the faith in the process. And that then leads to humility, because when those wines come to fruition and they are great, and many of them are, it is really easy for these winemakers to say, it wasn't me. I just got out of the way to allow the vines to be who they were called to be. I went into it with a desire not to put my signature on the bottle, but to allow the grapes to be the signature themselves. And so that tended to breed a natural humility. So faith in the process breeds humility. And I think in this style, looking for a terminology, this Taoist conception of Wu Wei really sort of arose as a means to make sense of what they were doing.
So it's interesting, because you would think that some people with their boutique vineyards or wanting to start a winery, that it's very ego driven, that they so much want to imprint themselves. And you're talking about the actual polar opposite. So can an ego driven wine be as tasty as a Wu Wei?
Yeah. So I mean, one of the things that I talked about in the book is, you know, I think there are Porsche wines and thoroughbred wines. So Porsche wines, you know, or Ferrari wines, let's say, you know, a Ferrari is a beautiful human constructed machine. And there's a certain like appreciation when you look at a Ferrari, even me, who's not a car person at all. You know, if I look at a Ferrari, I'm like, man, that there's something beautiful about that. And it's a testament to human ingenuity. It's a testament to human creativity and science to create that thing. And it's beautiful. But there's also the thoroughbreds of the world. You know, right down the road from where I live is Varian Ranch, you know, just a beautiful Arabian horse ranch. And you look at these prize-winning Arabian horses, and they're a thing of utter beauty. And it's not human constructed, though all the people who run Varian Ranch, you know, make sure it's good temperature, they get fed, that they, you know, they have all these things. So humans are involved in it, but the beauty comes from who they are. And so I think wines can be that Ferrari wines that are really constructed, but constructed in a beautiful way. And they're great. Penfolds Grange is a classic example of that, with the signature wine of Australia, highly constructed, but beautiful. And then there's the thoroughbred school, which is really showcasing the natural beauty of it. And both can make great wines. It's a little bit of a difference between, you know, the cathedral and Yosemite. But, you know, St. Peter's Basilica is a stunning tribute to God and humans. But so is Yosemite, a stunning cathedral made not by human hands. And so both are equally worthy of our admiration, but they're different in how they came about.
And so with our last few minutes, let's talk about the SBNRs, the spiritual but not religious winemakers. Do you have a story about one of them and how they find their connection to faith?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one of the trends that we see in religious studies as we witness the evolution of spirituality in America are people who are really hesitant to identify with a particular religious tradition. They're spiritual, but they don't want to call themselves a Christian or a Jew. You know, they want to sort of jettison themselves from that, and yet they have certain elements of their life that are deeply spiritual that they want to honor. And as I spoke with a lot of winemakers, there were certainly those in that framework as well that were maybe very consciously anti-religious, but yet they find their own spiritual path along their vocation, and often it's sort of unintentional. And I'll give you one example of a winemaker, a Indian winemaker in Walla Walla. He came from a tech background. His winery is called Rasa, which means source or pure, something like that. And he was facing a really difficult vintage. And he is I think he graduated from MIT, if I remember correctly, real, real down-to-earth scientist. And his partner at the time was trying to figure out what to do. And she just said, "Hey, can I put spiritual affirmations on the fermentation tanks?" And Bilo was like, "Ah, sure, whatever," thinking it wasn't going to do much, but how could it harm anything? And so she put on the fermentation tanks. "You are beautiful. You are loved. You are worthy." And while every other winery in that region had a really terrible vintage overall, Rasa made its best wines it ever made. And Bilo kind of transformed to be like, "I don't know what's going on here. I'm hesitant to thank God or spirit or source for that, but there's something there." And he became a convert to the spirituality of winemaking. Now, he still would never identify with a temple or a traditional religious worldview, but there's that part of him that now senses that there is something more, and I want to value that. And there's a number of different winemakers who have had these experiences in their profession that have led them into a deeper appreciation of the spiritual foundations of what we do.
My guest is Dr. Stephen Lloyd Moffatt, and we're talking about his new book, The Spirit of Winemakers, Finding Religion from Vineyard to the Bottle. And it's, I guess, the second, and I don't know if it's a series because there might be more to follow, I'm not sure. But the first book was The Spirit of Wine, Finding Religion in the Fruit of the Vine. And you can find these books by Googling with thespiritofwine.com, Stephen?
Spiritofwinebook.com.
spiritofwinebook.com. The stories are fascinating of each of the winemakers and how they came to find their way to doing this work and how they find their connection to God. And I, before I ever met you, many students have taken your class, and every student said the same: if you want to have your mind blown, take Dr. Steve Lloyd Moffat's class in religious studies. And his overriding message is always, I'm not going to tell you what to believe, but you need to believe in something. Does that still hold true?
Yeah, I mean, I think you need to be searching for something. And that conscientious search is an important part of a meaningful life. I mean, I think, you know, for many people listening, they're like, I'm not in the wine industry. You know, why is this book important to me? And, you know, it may not be important to everyone. That's fine. But in some sense, we're all searching for some meaning and depth in life. And what this book does is isolate a particular industry and acts as a case study of what motivates people beyond money, beyond prestige, beyond, you know, sort of the external elements of life. And in that sense, it can be inspiring as each of us tries to find some meaning in it, that we can stop and say, hey, looking back on my life, where were those points of inversion that I came to see life in a different way? Where were those lessons that in retrospect, I can tell mean so much more than just a pay raise or a title elevation? And taking an industry like wine that is filled with so many people who frame their existence in these bigger terms can be an inspiration to allow us to try to imagine what a more conscientious and thoughtful life can look like.
Thank you so much for spending an hour with me, Stephen. I miss seeing you at school, and I'm thinking maybe I need to drop in on your Zoom lectures so I can get a little bit of you more often. This has been a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. Find me on Facebook or Instagram, Elizabeth_TRT. Listen to previous shows at kcbx.org or podcast our shows to subscribe and listen at your convenience. As always, thank you for tuning in. Thank you for supporting Central Coast Public Radio KCBX. I will see you next Tuesday at 2.
Bartender, please fill my glass for me with the wine you gave Jesus that set him free after 3 days in the ground. Oh, and if I die before my time, oh, sweet sister of mine, please don't regret me if I die. Bartender, please fill my glass for me with the wine you gave Jesus that set him free after 3 days in the ground. Bartender, please fill my glass for me with the wine you gave Jesus that set him free.